Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I am pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Christopher Boucher. When you look at Christopher's bio, he would appear to have a lifelong obsession with cars, and more specifically, the Volkswagen. Memories of the Volkswagen go all the way back to his childhood, so who better person to bring you the book, How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive? This is Christopher's first novel, and when he's not writing this repair/self-help manual, Christopher keeps himself busy playing the banjo, and then a little thing, teaching literature at the Boston College. I'm sure that doesn't take much time. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Christopher Boucher.
Thank you so much, Beth, and thanks to the Tattered Cover Bookstore for inviting me here. I'm really honored to be here. I've never been to this bookstore before, and I am stunned by it. It's amazing. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I'm going to read a little bit from this novel that I just wrote that was just published a week ago today, How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive. It would, from the title, indicate that it tells you something about Volkswagens, and it doesn't tell you too much about Volkswagens, although it does, it is inspired by John Muir's 1969 book, How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive, right? If we know that book, we know how wonderful it is. It's amazing, and it's got these beautiful illustrations in it, and it tells you everything you need to know about Volkswagens. And happily, one of the results of this project has been that I've heard from John Muir's son, who is still alive, and he was nice enough to get in touch with me on my website, and he wasn't mad at me, which is nice. My book doesn't tell you much about how to keep your Volkswagen alive. What it does tell you, it's a novel, and it tells the story of a young man living in western Massachusetts, a town called Northampton, trying to raise his son, and his son is a 1971 Volkswagen Beetle. So just from that premise, you can probably deduce that it's a pretty surreal world, the world of this book. And there are some other things that make it surreal, or some other qualities that I should tell you about, because they might come up here. And that is that the character of the speaker has his father is kidnapped early on in the book, before the Volkswagen is born. And so there is something called the memory of my father, who you'll hear about here. And that's sort of like a ghost. It can do some things and not others. And there are also promises of characters. There are memories of characters and there are promises of characters. And they're sort of like bookmarks for the characters before the characters get there in the world. The other thing, I always forget this, is that in the book, time is actually money. So you'll hear reference to currency, and that currency is actually minutes or hours. So I know I'm sort of giving you a lot here, but just tell me if it gets too weird and we can back up, or I can just leave. So this first one actually is called Beneath the Underdog. I haven't read this before, but if I'm not going to read it here, I'll never read it. And I should say that it's inspired by the fact that my brother, right after college, my brother moved to Colorado Springs. And this is what sort of came out of the reflection of that experience for me. Beneath the Underdog. That spring, Colorado stole my brother. I came home to Long Meadow, a forgotten, out-of-circulation coin, and my parents told me the news. I walked in the doorway, and they were just standing there. Colorado wants Brian, the other side of my mother said. I should say there are two sides of his mother, one side of my mother and the other side of my mother. They're in love, one side of my mother said. Wait a minute, I said. The state of Colorado? The memory of my father, who was sitting by the window, nodded. Through the glass, I could see a pack of deer on the lawn, whispering among themselves. Colorado, one deer mouthed, and another nodded. The four of us ate pizza together, and then I drove back home through the fog, thinking about it. I was distracted by the VW, though, who was acting up and asking to go to a strip club. I'm in the mood, he whined. I'm in the middle of dealing with something serious right now. A very big change in my brother's life, I told the VW. We're just going to have to go another time, all right? The fog was something. Speeding through it was like being on the tip of a knife that was slicing through the body of a ghost. Please, Dad, the VW said. Please, please. There are other stories here about the castaway, VW. Tonight the story is, my brother's been stolen by Colorado, I told him. Colorado? No way I'm going out there, the VW said. I'd get halfway, break down again, and you'd start to yell at me rabbinical. I tapped the dashboard. You didn't use that word right, I said. Which word? Rabbinical. It's a religious term. I'm listening, like you said to, the VW whined. But the word has to come from your engine heart, I said. You can't just use it because it saves minutes. I should say, sorry, one more weird thing, and then I'll stop interjecting. The Volkswagen runs on stories, so there is always this negotiation about words and language and which words work. Will you stop picking on me? The VW said. You know what I meant. You're not helping things, okay? I said. When we got back to Northampton, I was angry. I picked up the phone and called Colorado. What? It said into the phone. I heard what you're doing, I said, and I don't like one bit of it. I don't think I give a fuck, Colorado said. I said, do you love him? I could hear his smile. He's a very nice young man. Why are you doing this? Are you in cahoots? Cahoots? It's a word, all right? Colorado sighed. You're wasting my time. You touch a hair on his head, I told him. I'll burn you down, inch by inch. It's a big world, partner. You take care of him, I yelled into the phone. You watch him. You make sure he sleeps well at night and stays happy at his job and is safe with the women and doesn't get sick. Are we done? Colorado said. I had no other threats to make. I just held the phone to my ear and listened to Colorado's breath coming through the receiver, filled with smoke and mountains. Please, I said into the phone. Okay, so I thought I'd read a total of three of these vignettes that make up the book, and then maybe we can have a Q&A. Does that sound good? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so this second one is called Street Woman. I tell you, my hands would get so wet and tired when I booked that I often had to take them off and dry them out on the back porch. After a while, I could only get one or two pages a day for them, and I was asked to do more than that at work alone. Then, I was trying to change a time-action filter on the Volkswagen one afternoon when one of my hands, soggy and limp, got stuck between the theater's asbestos firewall and curtain. Every time he opens up the Volkswagen, he sees something different. He often sees a theater, sometimes he sees an Olympic swimming pool, sometimes he sees a forest, so here he sees a theater. They postponed the show scheduled for that night, and a crew of tiny men, 15 or 20 of them, raised ladders and tried to help pull my hand out, but it just wasn't budging. Finally, I unscrewed the hand and left it there, and I went inside and called the memory of my father and told him the situation. He came barreling over in my father's old invisible pickup truck, looking like my dad had when I was 5. Scraggly beard, a full head of wild black hair, black square glasses, dark jeans, and a button-down shirt. The two of us got into my son, and I drove down onto Route 9. I didn't even have to ask where we were going. I knew the memory of my father was taking me to see the junk man. Well, I loved the revision of Route 2 and the Route 5 Mango Punch, and of course I'm excited about the new melodies when they appear, but my favorite road in all of western Massachusetts is Route 47, especially the stretch going from Hadley to Montague. Once you turn off 9, there is only one stoplight. The rest of the road is winding and fast, with surprises on each side. Beaming patches of land, grave sites, the Connecticut River, animals you might never have seen before. Once I saw what looked like a horse with a harp for a rear end, grazing in one of the pastures. Another time, I saw a cow riding a sit-down lawnmower, a Walkman over his ears, and a plastic cup in his hand. If you catch it right, Route 47 can get you anywhere you need to go. I don't know if it changes its mind in the night or what. The VW roared through Hadley and Sunderland and into Montague, a small, no-cheese town. I didn't even need to tell him where to turn. We pulled up beside the junk man's home, a collage of vinyl siding, shingles, cinder blocks, and pieces of old cars. There was no one around, just some bicycles playing in the yard. I told the VW to introduce himself to the bikes and to see if they might want to play, and the memory of my father and I walked around behind the junk man's house and looked out into the fields. It was spring, and the junk crop was rising high. Sprouts of old buses, ovens, bikes, toasters, VCRs, clothes, skis. Then, in the distance, I saw the junk man trudging through the rows, his beard dangling to his knees. He saw us, waved, and cupped his hand to his mouth. "What do you need?" he yelled. We walked towards him, and the memory of my father shouted back, "Used hand for my son," and pointed at me. I raised my arm, sans hand, and waved it like a court. The junk man led us through the fields and towards an old bus in the distance, half lodged in soil. As we walked, the memory of my father asked the junk man how things were going. "Busy, goddamn busy," he said. "People coming in every day, looking for cars, bikes, washers, dryers. They all wanted to be like new, though," he said. And when he smiled, I saw that his teeth had been replaced with what looked like plastic pieces from board games. I tell them, "I don't know if it works or not. This is a junk farm. You want something new? Go to Thorns." "Right," the memory of my father said, shaking his head. When we reached the bus, the junk man opened the door and motioned for me to step inside. When I did, I saw that the bus was filled with hands of every shape and size. The memory of my father stepped up behind me. "Jay, Chris," he said. The junk man stepped up into the bus and smiled. "Should I pick one or two or..." I asked. "Pick as many as you want," junk man said. 15 apiece. All afternoon, the memory of my father and I rummaged through hands. Finding the right one was not easy. Some were threaded differently than my wrist, and others fit all right, but were less responsive than my old hand. It was also hot and damp in the bus, and it smelled like some of the hands had rotted. Finally, I found a hand that seemed to fit. It was a little stiff in the thumb, but I hoped that some oil might be able to loosen it up. Just to be safe, I bought another complete set. They didn't fit as well, but they'd work as a backup in a jam. We walked back through the field in the late afternoon sun. As we rounded the corner, I saw the VW playing in the mud with an old laptop. "VW," I yelled, and he looked over at me, his face a freezer. "What?" he said. "Look at you. You're filthy," I said. He looked at his elbow. "I am not," he said. The junk man walked out from his house and pointed at the three hands that I was holding. "Find what you need," he said. The memory of my father took the hands from me and gave them to the junk man, and he took a look at each one of them. Then he said, "All three, 40 minutes. "Thanks," the memory of my father said. I paid the minutes and shook the junk man's hand with my one good hand, and then we got back into the VW. I put one hand on and put the spare hands in the trunk, and when I did, I saw that the hood was covered with mud. I got in the car, and we pulled onto Route 47. "VW," I said, "what did I say about playing in the mud?" "You never said anything about not playing in the mud," the VW said. "Did I, or did I not, tell you to make sure not to get dirty?" "He was just playing," memory of my father said. "I told you," I said to the VW, "that I don't have time to wash you every 2 seconds. You said dirt, but you never said anything about mud," the VW said. I started to tell him that it was the same thing, but then I heard a violent crunch in the engine compartment. I looked in the rearview mirror and saw brown smoke. "What's the matter?" I said to the VW. "I don't know," he said. "Something's burning, I think." I pulled the car over, got out, and opened up the engine compartment. When I did, I saw that my original hand, mangled and charred and now missing a few fingers, had slipped out from between the firewall and the curtain and was now caught in the flywheel. I reached my new hand in and pulled my old hand out. It was smoking, hot to the touch. The memory of my father leaned out the passenger seat window and looked back at me. "What's up?" he said. I didn't answer him. I just stared at the crushed hand lying on the pavement. I just kept thinking, this was the hand that I was born with? A smaller, weaker revision of my father's hand. And look what I'd done to it. Okay. So this last one appears a little bit later in the book. I see some people are reading as I'm reading, and it's page 170. It's called "I Would Die for You." I'm thinking back, going back in my mind to that Sunday in the fall of 2004, when the memory of my father and I went to the Flea Bee, the old Hadley Flea Market, held every week on a small farm on Route 47, and he bought a small war in a beautiful little wooden trinket box. Was that in 04? So long ago already? Yes, I think it was, because it was the same day that I bought the corpse of an old accordion who'd gotten in a bar fight and been stabbed and killed. I bought it from a mustache truck who was selling it for 2.5 hours. No guarantees, he said, as I handed over the time. He put the coffin in my arms. The instrument's bellows were stiff, its keys cold and gray. My hope, though, was that I might be able to fix the accordion and convince the VW to take lessons on it. I'd always loved the accordion, and so had my father. I brought the music corpse home and began working on it. I opened its skin at the seam, fed it fluids and nutrients intravenously, repaired its organs with epoxy and C-clamps, replaced two of its buttons, sewed its wounds, and reattached its skin. And a few days later, it opened its eyes and looked into my face. Oh, God, thank you, he said, weeping. But then the VW refused to play. That night, the night the accordion was resurrected, I put on some Cajun music for the VW to listen to, and he heard two notes and said that it was the least cool thing he'd ever heard. You don't like this stuff? I said. People actually listen to this, the VW said. It's nice. It's folky, happy. I said, it's a rosebush making fart sounds with its elbow, the VW said. So I had to kill the accordion all over again. The next morning, I set up a noose and a small stool in the front yard. I had the instrument stand in place on the stool while I slipped the rope around its neck. He flailed his tiny, keyed hands. Please, no, he begged. My son doesn't want you, I told him. I really thought he would. I need to live, the accordion said. But for what purpose, I reasoned with him. Who will play you? I could see his mind working. He stammered for an answer, but my job was clear and I did what needed to be done. I stepped back and kicked out the stool. The noose tightened. The accordion's eyes went wide. He coughed. Gawk! Gawk! And then his hands fell, and his head slumped forward. I kept him hanging there for a week, as a warning to other instruments. A few days later, I was sitting by the window, and I saw a French horn walking past on the sidewalk stop cold when he noticed the re-killed and hung accordion. His face was filled with fear. At the end of the week, I took the accordion down, laid him in his coffin, and buried him. I wonder whether I'll see him again. But I was talking about the trinket box with the war inside. The one the memory of my father bought at the Fleabee that day. As I said, he didn't mean to buy the war. He was just interested in the box, which was made of spruce and had some very interesting designs carved in the lid. As near as I could tell, the woodcuts told a story about a chariot in the Old West. There was one scene with a chariot in a duel, his wide-brimmed hat cocked back and his hand hovering over his holster. I was there when the memory of my father bought it, from a young girl who was watching the table while her mother went for coffee. He paid only 20 minutes for it, because the box was locked and the girl said the key had been lost. The memory of my father bought it and tucked it under his arm, and the two of us walked proudly back to the car, he with his story box, me with my coffined accordion. It wasn't until about a half an hour later, as we were driving home, that I picked up the box to study the scenes and heard noises coming from inside it. I put the box to my ear, and I could hear booms and crashes. I held the box out to the memory of my father, who was steering with one hand and holding a jelly donut with the other. "Listen to this," I said. I held it to his ear. "I just hear shifting," he said. "There's something happening inside this box," I declared. I tried again to open it, but couldn't. "I'm going to open this thing up and see what's inside it." "You do that and you're going to fuck up the lock and it won't be worth anything," the memory of my father said. "Just leave it be." "I won't fuck up a thing," I said. "I'll be careful." The memory of my father shook his head and bit into his donut. Later that day, the VW and I went down to my dad's workbench in the basement of the Crescent Street house, and we tried to loosen the lock. I let the VW try first. He tried to pick the lock with a paperclip, and then he took a tiny flathead screwdriver and tried to pry the catch. But I grew impatient, and after 10 minutes or so, I went and grabbed a crowbar. "Give me that thing," I told him. "Don't use that. You're going to snap the latch right off," the VW said. "I won't. I'll be careful." "Dad, give it," I said, and I took the box from him. I stuck the pry bar against the latch and turned it, which created a little gap between the two halves. I heard moans inside. "What's that sound?" the VW said. The latch wouldn't give. I pushed hard on the crowbar once, twice. "Careful. I'm being careful," I said, and pushed again, but this time the wood cracked. We both stared at what I'd done. "Did I tell you?" the VW said. I'd pried the lock right out of the wood, ruined the lid. I said a custom-made swear. "Didn't I tell you not to use the crowbar?" the VW said. "Just don't tell the memory of my father," I said. "Like he won't know." "He won't know, not if you don't tell him," I said. "I'm sick of you two conspiring against me." "What?" the VW said. "Everyone in this engine is conspiring against me," I said. "Dad," the VW said. His face was plaid. "Do you really think that?" I heard a soft boom inside the box, and then small voices. "You gonna open that thing, or what?" the VW said. "I'm getting to it," I told him. "Don't push me. I'll open it when I'm goddamn good and ready." "All right, all right," the VW said. I slowly opened the lid, and we both peered inside. Immediately, I knew what we were looking at. "It's a war," I whispered. It was night inside the box. The stars and the moon hung below me. Tiny men the size of eyelashes were running across a field. Then, the crack and flash of a bomb. All of the running men stopped and froze, then dropped back behind a hill. Gunshots came, and a new team of men surrounded them. All of the soldiers were of one mind. You could see it in their faces as they aimed and fired, ran and hid, destroyed the hearts of others, lost their legs and eyes, and either A, died, or B, did not die. The VW pulled back from the box and his face shawled. "What are they doing?" he said. I was upset, of course. What was this war about? And what was I supposed to do with it? "They're fighting," I said. "What for?" the VW said. "It's a disagreement of some kind." "Over what?" "I don't know the specifics," I told him. "It could be anything." The VW didn't say anything. He stared into the box at the dead on the field, and then he looked down at his shoes. "Can I go to my room?" I felt guilty all of a sudden. "Sure you can, buddy," I said. I placed the lid back on the box, and I called the memory of my father, and he came over an hour later. He sat down on a stool in front of the box. "Open it," I told him. "What'd you do here?" he said, pointing to the lid. "I don't know how that happened," I said. "You tried to pry it open, didn't you?" the memory of my father said. "I didn't touch it. The VW must have done that," I told him. We kept the war going through the fall. The memory of my father left the box in the basement, and every few days I would check on it and see what was happening. Many lives were lost. The sun rose and fell. I looked to see if there might be any end in sight, but I didn't have the whole thing. This box was apparently only one piece of a much larger conflict, so I never knew who was who and whether one side was making more progress than the other. One Sunday that winter, the memory of my father met an antiques collector at an estate sale. He told this man about the box and the designs on the front, and the collector said he'd like to see it. The memory of my father called me that afternoon and told me to clear out the war so that he could show the box to the collector. "How am I supposed to do that?" I asked. "You're a big boy. You can figure it out," memory of my father said. "Just scoop it out." Something inside me was sad. "Did you tell him about the lock?" "Bah," memory of my father said. "He won't even notice it." I thought long and hard about how to get rid of the war. I didn't want to just pour it out. Instead, I put the box in the freezer, thinking that all of the soldiers would freeze and die, and then I could dump the whole thing into the trash, hills and bunkers and bodies and all. But somehow, the soldiers survived the cold. I opened the box after 2 days in the freezer, and I saw a division dressed in fur, marching stiffly along a perimeter. By this point, I was using a magnifying glass, which I borrowed from my son's science kit, to see closer, and I could see every face as individual and unique. I saw two men huddled together for warmth, and another a few feet away, writing a letter. I snatched it from his hand and read it. "Things get worse all the time. This cold front is upon us, and every day we lose more men. My sergeant says that we will never give up, never die, but if I can't get warm soon, I don't think I'll make it. I think back to home. Remember the shower day, that Tuesday before the concert? I think of you and how warm that was. God, my hands. I can't hold the pen. Have to go. I'll write again tonight. Love." I brought the box with me when I went home that night for dinner, and I held it out to the memory of my father. "The war's still in there," I told him. "What?" he said. "I told you to clear it out." "I tried to freeze them, but it didn't work. Just get them out of there, what the fuck?" the memory of my father said. Then he took the box under his arm and went outside. The late afternoon sun was a piece of candy. The memory of my father turned on the hose and opened the box. All of the fighting stopped, and the soldiers looked up into their sky, past their sun, and into the memory of my father's face. He sprayed the inside hard, until all the dead bodies and the hills and streams and stars and moon were pushed out onto the pavement, and within minutes the box was completely empty. With his holy hose, the memory of my father forced them down the driveway and towards the gutter at the curb. The antiques collector didn't buy the box. He was upset when he saw that it had a broken lock. And so the memory of my father brought it home and stored it in his garage. A few years later, I found the box again, dusty and stashed in a corner. I opened it up and peered inside. I saw 6 or 7 men huddled around a fire. I think there was a crude map of some sort at their feet. It looked to me as if they were making plans. And I'll stop there. Thank you so much. Can I answer any questions? Jeez. Yeah.
I read this a few weeks ago, and I was really curious about the Miss Florence Diner. I kept thinking I was going to get to meet the Miss Florence Diner, and I think there's a little bit of mystery and intrigue there. I'm curious.
Yeah, I'm glad that... So the question is, at the beginning of the book, the table of contents is listed at the morning tables of the Miss Florence Diner. And then the Miss Florence Diner doesn't really become a character in the book. So the question is, what's that about? I have sort of two answers to that. The first answer is, it may become a character later on, you know, in another project. The reason that I say it may and the reason that it's not here is because the Miss Florence Diner is one of many, many sort of landmarks or places in Western Mass that I have these really fond memories of, you know. And so it just seemed to me that it seemed really organic to me that if I was going to have some sort of collective, in this case, a collective of stories, I just pictured people on the stools at this wonderful diner called the Miss Florence Diner, which is actually in a little village in Western Mass called Florence. And it became just sort of a quirky way to address the table of contents. But I tend to circle back around to those things, you know, and this was one that I just sort of let be for this book. But I'm quite certain that I'll circle back to it. Yeah. Yeah. And I have such fond memories because I lived in Northampton for a number of years and often had a chance to meet family members or friends there for breakfast. For a while there, I was going to the Florence Diner every morning, for better or for worse. Yeah. Yes. So the question is, as I'm writing, is this strange language organic, you know, or how does that sort of come about? It's changed over time. You know, in my second year, this book took about 10 years to write, amazingly enough. And it hurts me to say that. Well, thanks. In my second year at Syracuse, where I got my MFA, I had this sort of stylistic break, and I realized that I really wanted to work a lot more with music than I had worked with before. You know, I was writing pretty straightforward stories that were sort of modeled after the work of some of my favorite writers at the time, like Raymond Carver or Tobias Wolff or Stuart Dybeck or Ann Beatty. And all of a sudden, I realized I have such a love for music. You know, I play music very poorly, but I play music, and I thought I really want to trade direct meaning and what one would expect from a sentence for some sort of musicality here, and I'm willing to sort of at least try taking that risk. And so I would say the process of writing this book in many ways was sort of a process of getting in tune, and then I wasn't always in tune, but I would always, those words are in there because they happened as I was writing, and I was reluctant to change them. You know, I was fearful that they would be read as a gimmick, you know, or that they would be read as not organic. And in fact, they were to me. You know, those words were words that somehow captured something that the word the other word that I might put there didn't. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, you know, once I came to the realization that I had no plot, how did I deal with that? And you know, what happened was I started the book in 2000 or 2001, and in 2003 my father had this really serious heart attack, you know, and he survived, thankfully, but I'm really, really close to him. And the fact that he survived and the fact that I had this sort of immense gratitude to the universe, you know, for him being here, and also this sort of new fear that I really felt like I was never going to be able to shake, that, you know, that life is precious and I can't take anything for granted, and that I was so close to losing him, became this sort of pivot point for the plot that developed. So, you know, in the months following, I think that I had sort of a new voice and sort of a new momentum for the book. And I spent all this time, I remember deciding, I'm going to write the entire plot of this book in one story, and I'm not going to do anything else until I write that one story. I'm just going to write that story and write that story. And I wrote, like, you know, 20 versions of that one story. And that story is the story that begins the book. That story is sort of the kidnapping of the father by something called a heart attack tree, you know? And that is this conflict that spins the whole book from there on out. It seemed organic to me because it seemed like it was dealing with the themes that were already at work in the book, these themes of father and son, and these themes about sort of knowledge and agency, you know, what one can get done and what, you know, it seems like this character, this speaker, he doesn't know how the Volkswagen works and he doesn't know what happened to his father. And he seems sort of always a step behind. And so what I was writing with that starting point seemed organic to me. And that's how it happened. You know, once I sort of decided that, I thought, okay, now I have a problem or another problem, and I have to, that problem's going to carry me forward, you know? And even so, still from that point out, I spent a lot of time, I thought the book was going to go much further. And then I realized that I had to sort of change my timing and change my relationship to the sequence of the book. It was a real sort of, there were some real growing pains there as I figured out how to do it. Beth, I'm conscious of the time. Should we wrap up?
I'll take one more question.
Okay, great. Yeah.
You mentioned this was inspired by the actual how to keep your Volkswagen Lot manual.
Yeah.
How did the section you read us, I would die for you, whatever, how does that relate to the original manual?
It doesn't relate too much. I mean, the way that inspired me was, I have a 71 Volkswagen at home. You know, I bought it before I went to Syracuse, when I was working as a reporter in Western Mass. I drove it. I was a daily driver for me. And when I got it, the mechanic that sold it to me, he sold me all his pieces and parts. You know, he sold me a brand new cylinders in the J.C. Whitney boxes, put them in the front compartment. And he said, here's the thing. You have a lot of new parts here. Don't ever call me. You know, don't ever want to hear from you. You know, don't ask me what I can do. You know, don't ask me any problems. And then I drove it out of there, and it, you know, was stalling because the carburetor had a bad carburetor, and it was only $300. So anyways, he left me the book in the back seat, How to Keep Your Volkswagen Alive. And that was the first time that I had seen it. And it was this wonderful, you know, it was the old wire bound copy. It was stained with oil, and I brought it to school with me. And I was fascinated at the time by found material. You know, a lot of the sentences in here, the titles are found. And one day I just used the title, and soon thereafter, probably the same day, there was a talking Volkswagen. And then I decided, if I'm going to do this, I've got to really devote myself to this structure. You know, some vignettes are much more related and referential to that structure than others. You know, like there is a vignette called Tools and Spare Parts. There is a vignette called Shimmies and Shakes, you know, and there are those in John Muir's book as well. But there are also these vignettes that don't quite relate, you know, except that they're in the book. Yeah. So I'm happy to sign books or to chat further. But I really want to thank you for being here. This was a total pleasure for me. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.